succession of 3-2-1-2-1. Rule three.
What was their attitude to be AOR, do you think, to having...
Oh, they were okay. Being occupied made no difference to them. Many of them worked in the barracks anyway and that sort of thing. They were grateful to have them. No, I don't think they felt... They must have felt it in the first instance when they saw the troops coming in and so on and realised that they'd been... militarily defeated. Yes, they must have felt that, but then that sort of died away, and it was, I never met any non-cooperation or anything like that.
And what was your attitude towards the Soviets? Because you said you felt sorry for the East Germans, but obviously they were different from the
no,
Soviets.
No, I think, you see, I'd made a study of communism, and I realised that by then the evils of Stalin and his group. I thought the Soviets were more powerful than they were, they had those 22 divisions, and they only had to start out, and with our handful it would have been difficult to hold them. So I think that one went in a certain amount of trepidation, especially when they got the atomic bomb. That made all the difference, and Stalin and his group were so evil that it, we know now to the smallest detail, but it was fairly obvious. And I can remember going out on exercise once, and this is an old boy standing by his farm gate, you know, and I went along and said good evening. I said good evening. He said, Stalin is dead. Stalin's dead. You see, and there were celebrations everywhere. The Germans hated him. He was a certain... I would say that there must have been a real threat at one time, but it wasn't as powerful as I thought it was.
Because you talk about that feeling as well, always, of always there being this threat. Because you lived in Germany with the fear of invasion.
Yeah, I think you did. Because you realised that you... you weren't necessarily strong enough yourself. It would have come to using atomic weapons, I'm almost sure, because we weren't strong enough militarily to have withheld them. And in their exercises, Victoria, they had a lot of exercises, and they had to notify us when they were doing a big one and so on. They had big training areas, the Letzlinger Heide, the others that we used to watch. When they did these exercises, they never practiced the defence. They only ever practiced the assault. And that was significant to us, you know, that they were ready. But they weren't as well organised or coordinated. I mean, for instance, only officers read maps. The ordinary soldier wasn't allowed to read a map. He wasn't allowed to educate himself to read a map. And so, of course, a lot of these exercises, it was a big cock-up. All sorts of things used to go wrong, and we realised then that they weren't as clever as we thought they were. But 22 divisions, of which I can't remember, so it must have been something like 6 armoured divisions. Well, that's a hell of a lot.
How many on the other side?
On our side, we had the 3 or 4 that we had. We had the Americans had about 9, and the Germans eventually 12. So would have been a balance in the end, but in the early days, I think it was quite susceptible.
And you said when you filled in the questionnaire about... you said... You were as surprised as anyone in 1989 when it collapsed.
But
you
down.
Said there was writing on the wall in my day. What do you think? What do you mean by that?
Well, that there was a reasonable current of opposition that used to flare up every now and again. I'm trying to remember the date. The Berlin riots, 17th of July or something like that, and that flared up. And so you realise that there were people who, if they could organise themselves, were in a position to revolt and say that they, because they they had no democracy. They had nothing. It was a complete and utter Soviet dictatorship run by these Germans, who were, you know, only too happy to do it, Mr. Honecker or whatever his name was. And so yes, but there was always there were always groups that I'm sure were ready, and they got caught every now and again, but that showed that they were there.
And you said when you were doing your thing with your family, I think,
no,
that's when the 56 Hungarian uprising happened.
Oh, they went for me. They said, what are you doing sitting here? You know, you should be out against... Because they always had this idea, and it was very prevalent, as you know, towards the end of the war, that they would get the Allies to turn round with them and attack the Soviets. You say, well, there's no intention of ever doing anything like it. But this lingered in their minds, and they said, well, what are you sitting here for when you could be going and helping the Hungarians? Well, of course you couldn't. There was not an open hell.
So the Germans thought you should just march into Hungary?
Yeah. And I said, no, it's not as quite as simple as that.
Okay, just a couple of other things about this period of your life, if that's all right. You said in when you filled in the questionnaire that it was all a bit like playing a game sometimes.
Yeah, I think it was a bit like the game. You know, as I said to you, they it was a bit like Kim and so because you it was earnest enough. Of course it was, but you were trying to devise little stratagems that would eventually lead you somewhere. Somebody came up with one, and when you could go into an area after the Soviets had, we wanted to know all their post office numbers, because that would then lead to helping with this idea of where divisions were and so on.
That seems to be the ultimate sort of aim, was to
find them as much detail as you could, so that if anything should happen, the unit opposite those divisions knew what their capabilities were. You were trying to assess capabilities, you were trying to assess their readiness and state of training and so on. And so they'd go out on exercise, and we had we got all our sources together, and we had them going out and picking up pieces of paper, letters, i.e. that some Russian had used when he'd gone to the toilet. And that then gave you the post office number. You see, oh, often it did, it didn't always. And poor old Bish was the chap, but he was sitting there with his gloves on, trying to work out, because his Russian was excellent, and tried to work out which unit was which, or however it could help him. And so we got a tremendous amount out of that, tremendous amount. Because, you know, we had post numbers in Germany. We were BOR, whatever it was, and so on. And the Soviets had the same. And if you could find those out, that gave you lots of good clues. That did.
It seems to me that one of the most extraordinary things is these Bricksmiths guys driving.
Oh yes,
I mean, that's a good that.
Yeah. Well, it was run, first of all, when I first went there, it was run by a chap called Pope, Brigadier Pope, and he was very enterprising old Pope, but he didn't like being pushed about. And what the Soviets used to do was they used to get the East Germans to push Bricksmiths about. If you went, they said, oh no, this is a restricted area. You can't go in there, it's a restricted area for some reason or other, you see. Well, we'd go in it anyway because under the Robertson-Marlenian agreement, all that rubbish. And then on one occasion, Pope went in, and because he was very active himself. It was a brigadier's post in those days, and this East German fired at him. So put his rifle up and fired. So Pope fired back. So he lost the job. And the chap that took over then was very enterprising. He died a few years ago. couple of years ago, FitzAlan Howard, who was, later Premier Duke, although they're Catholics, and, you know, they're based in Arundel, aren't they? And anyway, FitzAlan Howard, one of the FitzAlan Howard brothers, ran Bricksmiths, and they were very enterprising. They weren't all Russian speakers, but they had a good smattering of Russian speakers. They, if you said to them, we want you to do this, this or this, they were very good at getting into the area surreptitiously. They'd say, but perhaps go at night or something like that. So the following morning when the exercise started, they were up on the high ground and looking at it and making assessments and so on. Yeah, they were very good.
So they'd go out on...
Socksmiths didn't. Socksmiths was just a purely... Socksmiths ran agents. Quite funny.
This was the
because
Soviet.
The Soviet one, and they ran agents, and they'd go and they'd have their what do we call them, the sort of drop thing, a hole in a wall in a bridge and all that sort of rubbish. So you'd let them play those games because they weren't very important. But the Stasi ran an enormous number of agents in West Germany. Or every barracks and everything, they soaked it up, and I would almost guarantee that my name's on the Stasi records, because they would have had somebody at Mönchengladbach and in Rheindahlen and so on.
Did that worry you?
No, not now. It's all history, isn't it?
But at the time, were you worried about?
No. I don't think so. I think towards the end, I became convinced that the Soviets weren't as powerful as we thought they were, and certainly their ideas led to... I couldn't see the wall coming down because the secret police were so good, and the Stasi were so good at detecting and locking people away and so on. You won't have seen the film, but there's an excellent film called The Lives of Others.
Well, I've seen it.
Have you?
About East Germany.
Oh, it's so sad, isn't it? So sad. And that's what they were up to all the time. And so well organised. I couldn't see it coming, couldn't see it coming apart. But it did. And then when Gorby came in, it was fairly obvious it was crumbling, wasn't it? It was even crumbling when Khrushchev opened up about Stalin. Mm. Now they try to resurrect him. Yeah.
Okay, should we just quickly talk about going to Nigeria? Because I'm sure there's a Cold War sort of... Well, what was the perspective? When you moved to Nigeria, it must have been rather strange in comparison to being in Germany.
Yes. Again, I was the intelligence officer, of course. But the whole thing had gone down about 10 levels. You were wondering about what Tiv tribesmen were going to be doing and that sort of thing. And of course, independence was coming up. But you kept your eye on people that you thought might upset the apple cart. There was one Nigerian officer in particular, whose name escapes me, that I didn't like, and indeed in the end he did. When it came to the Biafran conflict, he did betray Ojukwu, who was a Biafran leader, not a Carrefour. Anyway, so you watched for that, and then really. As I say, it was very Tubney Aitney stuff. We were occupying the Cameroon. The old German Cameroons had been split between the French and the British. And in the French part, there was a lot of dissension. They had a set of people who were taking various actions and so on. And then when the French chased them, they'd come into ours. And so we had to keep Martin Singat was the prime mover in French in French Cameroon, and the French got him in the end. But and he came in, and then various others would be chased in, but they were very basic. They were very. We caught one chap, and he said, strip off, you know, let's have a look. And he had got all this rubbish, sort of cowrie shells and bits and pieces. And we said, what are these for? Oh, he said, that one he make you go tell me if anybody on the route. We said, well, it didn't work, did it? Ambushed him and got his cowrie shells. It was very basic.
Were you sorry to leave Germany? Were you sorry to leave Germany?
No, because I knew I could go back, and I did go back, and I do go back. No, I think it was move on time, wasn't it, you see?
Was there a concern about communism in Africa?
Yeah, there was a bit, but it wasn't high powered. This particular chap that I'm trying to think of went to university, went to the first Nigerian university, and he was communist. And when I went, I inherited the files on him, and so he was a bit way out left. But no, there wasn't a great communist threat. I think the people, they were quite wily, the Africans. I mean, they used to play off the one against the other. And they'd take the communist money, Chinese money or Russian money or whatever it was, and they'd put it in their pockets.
So you left the army then in 1923?
Yep, and then went into teaching.
But I can see that you joined the TA, so you're still in touch.
Went straight in. When we were on the boat, just about to leave Lagos, I had a very good friend, Dougie Manson. Dougie taught me pidgin, and he'd been out before. He served with the Nigerian army before, and then he came again. And I used to go out with Dougie, and he'd say, you've got a master pidgin. He said, because if you don't, they'll smile and say yes, and then what you said, you see. And we went into a barracks once, and Dougie said, we were in a jeep, and he said, I wonder if I can get down there. So a corporal, and the chap came over, he said, motor, he go that way? He said, motor, he never go that way, master. Oh, rode him past motor vehicles, you see. And so I learned pidgin in the end, and so that you could speak to soldiers. They say there isn't any pidgin now, but of course there probably still is. And you could speak to soldiers with in their own. I had my intelligence sergeant. I'd ring up. I'd go. The headquarters was in two parts. One was at a Papa, and the other was in Lagos proper. And I'd go from Lagos around to a Papa, and I'd think, oh God. Traffic's so awful, I can't get back. So I'd ring up, and it's Sergeant Sunday. And Sergeant Sunday, and I'd say, they hated talking on the phone because their voice was part of their personality, and it was going out into the ether and not coming back. With a radio, they would Morse, fantastic, with a Morse. Try giving them a radio where the voice went out. That's part of their personality was going. I mean, I know it sounds crude, but that's a way that lots of them still felt. And so when they picked the phone up, they'd say, oh ho. This is a sort of traditional thing. And, oh ho. And I say, sound Sunday. He said, I'm the very one. I said, sound Sunday. This is Captain Harrington. He said, no, the captain, he no day. I said, no, I know I know day. I day for a papa. He said, that right. He said, the captain, he day for a papa. Well, so in the end, you get through. But
so you were working for the British Army in Nigeria?
No, I was working for the Nigerian Army.
And then, a colony then?
Yeah, and then when I was on a contract, in fact, there were seconded officers, British seconded. When I first went, there was no battalion commander. There were four battalions. And there was no Nigerian battalion commander because they'd been slow in coming through. There were Nigerian officers, And then eventually, when freedom he done come, as they say, they gave one of the battalions to a Colonel Irontsi. And by then the Congo had erupted, the Belgian Congo, and they were waiting for us to get independence, and then we sent two battalions. We sent a brigade, which was two Nigerian battalions and a Ghanaian battalion, but it was under a British brigadier. We had a general there, and then we had two brigadiers, Brigadier North and South, and one of them went ward something or other. He spoke very good Swahili, and he went down to command the first brigade that worked with the United Nations in the Congo. And then later, again, we changed over, and it wasn't a long time until the Nigerians got to the top.
So were you in Nigeria for independence?
Yeah, for freedom. Oh, yeah.
Really?
They all thought, it's going to change. It's going to get nothing changed, of course. Freedom, we done come, you know. Independence, that's right. Yeah, independence.
So you came back to England, and
I know what it was. I was going to take an external degree in German, that's right. And so I wrote off to the Imperial College and said, look, I want to take it. And they said, yes, no problem whatsoever, you can take this externally. They were the only people who did external degrees, of course, in those days. And so they said, we want 3 A levels in an art subject and Latin at O level. And I said, well, what had I got? I'm brought up during the war. A lot of army certificates, and that was about it. So I wrote back and said, look, I passed the staff college examination and so on. They said, no, that's all right, 3 A level. So anyway, I thought, damn it. And I got correspondence courses, and I took A levels in geography, history, and German, obviously.
This was while you were in the army?
While I was in the Nigerian army, in a year. All right? And I sat down night after night. I used to sweat, and you know, I'd have to have a towel over here, you know, writing all these answers and so on. Anyway, in the end, I had to abandon the Latin, but I took the 3 A levels and I got them. And then I changed my mind, and I thought, no, I'll go into teaching. So I wrote to St. Luke's at Exeter, and I said, look, I've just got these 3 A levels. They said, well, don't come for interview, just come in September. And I went to St. Luke's at Exeter, did a 2-year course, came out and went into teaching.
Why did you decide to leave the army?
Mainly because I took the redundancy, I took the money, and we bought a house. And that was a very wise move. The redundancy, I can't remember, was about $5,500. And it was good. So there were too many gunners, there were too many artillerymen, you see. And so they said, you can transfer to another corps, or you can take the redundancy. So I took the redundancy. As I say, we bought the house, and that was it, really. And then, because we had the house in Crowborough, I went back to Crowborough and got a job there in a primary school. And then within 4 years, I got my headship, my first headship. Lovely, lovely little country school.
You joined the TA, so you kept...
That's Dougie Manson, of course. That's he's on the boat going home. He came to see us off and he said, Peter, when you get home, go around and join the TA. He said, you'll get part... He said, because you'll miss your soldiering. He said, and so go, you'll get part-time soldiering. He said, and somebody pays you for doing it. And so I went straight to... higher barracks in Exeter when I got there, and I said, I want to join up. And they said, well, we're looking for an intelligence officer for the brigade, 133 brigade, I think it was. And so I joined, and that's it. And then I stayed throughout, and I was very fortunate because I stayed well over my years. I was what was known as a survivor. I should have gone much earlier. But I didn't, and I stayed on, and in the end, of course, I got my little MBE. So that was, as a result of being in 220 Field Ambulance, as it was then. and Queenie gave it to me, so that was an added bonus. Pat came up and Alex came up, and added bonus, because wouldn't have wanted to get it from Charles.
We didn't hear that. It's not going to be recorded. No. just to go back to the Cold War, yeah. Because you know you're in England now, and but the Cold War's still going on, obviously.
Yes.
Do you think you could talk a bit about how it seemed, sort of, from the home front compared to how it had been in Germany?
Yeah, I think that one still had the feeling that it could come to a conflict, and then atomic bombs would be used, and so you always had that feeling. For instance, you'd go out on exercise in Germany, a lot of it with your TA unit and that sort of thing. Eventually, when the army got round to realising what an asset the TA was, so you'd go out on exercises and you'd still had that same feeling that there something might happen. Of course it never did, but you were conscious of the fact that and a lot of your exercises were done up against the frontier, which I found interesting.
But you must have had that view, whereas the people that you were, the parents of the children you were teaching, what do you think they thought about the Cold War?
I don't think it really, they thought about it a great deal. I don't think there was the same, you see, when during the war we were so interested in the news and what was happening, and we were aware, but I don't think people, you know, once it was virtually all over, as it were, I don't think it was down to a few experts and people like that, and people were conscious of it. I don't think the general public ever gave a two hoots as to, I don't think they really thought about it. They might have done now and again when there was a crisis. I can remember somebody coming to me and saying, you've got a cellar, this is in our old house, why don't we turn it into an atomic shelter, you see? And I said, well, I don't think it's going to come to that, Barry, but at least he was thinking about it, you see. And that was because there was some, I can't remember what the crisis was, it might have been Kennedy or whatever. And so that brought it back into focus, didn't it? Then it would die away again. I don't think people were as up into world affairs as we were when we were younger.
So it was quite in the background for most people?
I think so. I don't think it really disturbed them. I mean, the chaps, yes, your fellow TA chaps, I mean, they thought about it, but I don't think a lot of others did.